content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or in discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B in Raleigh. Our guest this week on Salute a Veteran Every Day is a very special one, a 13-year Air Force veteran, Caroline Urban. And if that last name sounds familiar, Caroline is my wife. Caroline, welcome to Salute a Veteran Every Day.
My pleasure to be here today.
Tell me, and more importantly, the listeners, how did you first come to be in the Air Force?
I came through ROTC. I went through Weber State University in Ogden, Utah, with a crosstown agreement with the University of Utah. That was in Salt Lake City. Got my commission through there. Did my initial training down at Tyndall Air Force Base. I was assigned as a weapons controller for the Air Force when I first came in. And I did a couple months training there, and then I went on to Luke Air Force Base to have some additional upgrade training.
That's in Arizona,
that's correct. And then following that, first assignment was overseas in Germany in a northern post called Bremerhaven, way up northern part of Germany off of the North Sea. And I was there for about 6 months and then was transferred down to central Germany, base called Wiesbaden. It was an army base near Frankfurt in the center of Germany, and I was there for about 2 years. And then came back to the United States following that assignment and went to Hill Air Force Base, where I worked in various administrative positions and admin and protocol. And I was there for about 2 years, and then from there moved to California, Southern California, San Bernardino.
With your new husband.
With my new husband, that's right, that's right. We had what we called a joint spouse assignment together, our first assignment, and we went to San Bernardino and spent about 2 years there. And following that, we went to Washington, D.C. together. And we spent about 5 years in D.C. I had several different jobs while in the D.C. area. I worked at the Pentagon for about 2 years, and then I had an assignment with private industry. It was called Education with Industry, and I worked with Eastman Kodak Company for 1 year there in D.C. And following that assignment, I stayed in D.C. again and went to what we call the Defense Logistics Agency. Their headquarters was there in Cameron Station, and I was there working senior officer assignments for about 2 years and had my first child there. Following that assignment, we were transferred down to Florida and went to Hurlburt Field. Special Operations Command was just starting, and I was assigned there as their information management officer, running the information management for the command. At the time, it was just starting up, and spent about 2 years there at Hurlburt. And then at about the 13-year point of my career, then I had my second son and decided that the Air Force at the time was having a drawdown, and they were offering some incentives for people to separate, to leave the service. And I took that opportunity at that time to make a career choice, a wise one for me and my husband, and raise my children for a couple of years. And so we separated and stayed on in Florida for a few more years before we left. So that was the end of my professional career as an Air Force officer.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. And what interested you in joining ROTC at Weber State?
I grew up in an Air Force family. My father was a career military person. He was enlisted, and we traveled around quite a bit growing up, moved 12 years in Europe growing up, and he retired from the Air Force when I was 16, and we lived in Utah at the time, and I had always enjoyed being in a military lifestyle, being around the base, the activities that were there for families and military members, and I would see women that were in the military at that time, and this was, you know, my formative years, and I always thought that that was a great opportunity for women. I thought that they offered women career opportunities that were outside the mainstream of what women were doing back then in the 60s and 70s. And so that was always something that I guess I saw as an opportunity for me as a woman, that it would offer me advantages that I maybe could not always achieve in the civilian world at that time. So it was always an option for me. And then when I got to the university, they had an ROTC unit where you go in with a commission as an officer. And so that really, you know, I thought, well, I could use my degree and still have a career in the military as an officer, that I thought would be something that I would want to do, that it was a challenge and an opportunity that I wanted to do. I just didn't see myself going to school and getting married at the time, at the climate, growing up in Utah at the end of my high school years. A lot of women, you know, that was their goal, was to get married and have children. And I just never felt like I fit in to that type of culture, and wanted to just have a challenge. And I just felt like the military would give me an opportunity to travel and get educated and, you know, to have a career. So that was the choice that I made for myself, and was positive.
What was your major in college?
I was a sociology social work major, and I had worked various career fields in career, you know, opportunities in counseling and with children, and that was something that, you know, that I had enjoyed doing. So,
were you able to use those skills in the military at all?
You know, when I supervised people, and you'd have to counsel people for different reasons, those skills did, you know, did come into play, to be able to talk to people and counsel them and advise them. I mean, those were skills that I was able to transfer into my military job.
So your first assignment was at Tyndall, which is Panama City, Florida. What was that like?
That was the first time I'd ever been to the South. I remember leaving Utah at the time and we flew into Atlanta, and I got off the plane in Atlanta, and I could all of a sudden feel this humidity. Here I was coming from a desert area, and I just thought, oh, my goodness. It just felt like all this moisture was coming into my lungs from the humidity. And then we get into Tyndall later that evening. It was dark at the time, and there's a bus there to pick us up and take us from the airport there and drive us out to the base. And driver drops us off at the billeting office, is where you sign in to, you know, get your room. It's like a hotel office. And the bus door opens, and I hear all this sounds, and I thought, what is that noise? And the driver, what are you talking about? I said, that noise out there in the dark, what is that? And he goes, oh, those are just frogs, you know. So it was all these bullfrogs out there. So it was interesting coming to the South, my first time to the South. And, you know, I had some apprehensions about it a little bit, but it all worked out great, and I enjoyed it. And I spent about 2 months there at Tyndall in training, right on the beach, beautiful white sands. First time I'd ever seen that white, sugary sand of the Emerald Coast. And it was just a beautiful, you know, beautiful time to be there. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
What was the type of training that was that getting you ready then to go to Luke and then to go to Germany?
Yes, that was the introductory assignment into the weapons controlling career field. You learned about radar and managing a screen and directing aircraft. Weapons controllers primarily support the Army at the time. It was a ground support operational job. And you would, as the Air Force, you would be the contact with the fighter pilots and the aircraft that would come in to help clear a site if troops, you know, were under danger or under attack, or they needed to fight off other enemy aircraft. So the training was to help direct aircraft into a weapons zone, into a conflict area. So that was my initial training there, and it was about 2 months. And then from there, you follow on with assignment to where you're going to be assigned. And at the time, I would be assigned with the Tactical Air Command, and so you would get training how those aircraft perform and what their support role is with the Army. So
was that at Luke?
That was at Luke. That was a follow-on at Luke, yes, in Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, yes. And I was there for about 2 months. It was a good, you know, it was an enjoyable assignment.
Was that kind of a new thing? Was that unusual for a woman officer to be assigned to?
At that time, when I got out of the university, they were just allowing women to enter into pilot training, and they were really trying to recruit women into the operational career field. So it was the beginning of women being accepted into the operational side as far as pilots, navigators, and weapons controllers. So, you know, we were, you know, within those years, it was the beginning of women coming into those career fields, operational career fields.
Did you ever experience any chauvinism?
No, I never did. You know, my contemporaries, the people that I worked with, were younger people that, you know, had just gone through school, and women were just coming into having careers, and they were, you know, getting degrees at, you know, greater numbers. And so sometimes I guess some of maybe the senior NCOs or senior officers weren't sure, but they were all very, you know, after you got to know them and you work with them, they were very accepting, and they would try to help you and get you, you know, used to the new job and the role, and, you know, offer their sage wisdom and advice and experience on different, you know, issues that you had. So I never really felt any type of discrimination or hesitation of being a woman.
What was your age?
Trailblazing. I was 26 when I first came in the Air Force.
And your rank?
I was a second lieutenant.
Mm-hmm. So from Luke to Germany?
Went right to Germany. I was assigned into a squadron, and it was a squadron that had about, we probably had about 250 people, all Air Force people assigned there. Mm-hmm. And we were way up in a northern port city of Germany. A lot of Army were up there, and that was our mission, was to help support the Army troops when they deployed within NATO.
Mm-hmm.
NATO, within with what they did to help support the NATO troops at that time. And so it was an experience, never really having been around the Army before, learning their culture and their ways. And sometimes that was a little bit, you know, you would get a little bit more pushback being a woman in that side than we did in the Air Force. I always felt like the Air Force was probably a little bit more progressive and led the way mm-hmm. for the other services as having women in the various operational career fields.
Mm-hmm. But this was your first real assignment. Those others were training.
Correct.
So what did you actually do with the Army?
We would deploy. We would set up deployments where we would go out and support various exercises that would be going on within NATO. And you would have training where you would go out and actually bring aircraft in for different exercises that had to support the Army troops on the ground. And it was like a where you would think an air traffic controller controls airplanes and keeps them apart. A weapons controller brings the aircraft together, so they will have what we would call dogfights or interaction, where, you know, the aircraft could train mm-hmm. for a war type situation. And so they would be Air Force, both planes would be Air Force planes, but they would just train for warlike positions if there were ever a contingency where they had to intercept, say, a Russian aircraft, as mainly at the time is what we were looking at, a Russian aircraft that went over the border of the NATO countries. And so that was our main mission, was to train for close air support mm-hmm. and to monitor airspace and make sure that, you know, there weren't any violations of unidentified aircraft that were from other countries entering airspace over the NATO mm-hmm. Countries at the time.
So, and how are you talking to these pilots? You've got
on radio. You would have radio frequencies that you would turn into for operational mm-hmm. control, and you know, different I guess bandwidths would change regularly, and then you would have access to that information. You would tune in, and you would identify the aircraft on the screen, the radar mm-hmm. screen, and you would direct them that way.
Mm-hmm. So there were U.S. aircraft playing the good guys and also U.S. aircraft playing the Russians or
correct,
the bad guys?
Correct, mm-hmm. correct.
And did you hear any humorous banter between them while they were flying? Or
you would, yeah, you would hear a little bit, you know, between the pilots, because you could hear the pilots talking to each other and you know, that kind of camaraderie, you know, that would go on back and forth between each other.
Mm-hmm. So they probably knew each other.
Yes. Usually the pilots probably came out of the same squadrons, or at least the same wings. Mm-hmm. And so they would train together. And so, yes, they did know each other. And they would, you know, they would be up there exercising and training, and we would just track and give them their bearings and location at all times. So, you know, they had their own radar within the aircraft, but we were just an extra set of eyes mm-hmm. that helped, you know, watch out for no interference from other outside aircraft, say civilian aircraft or commercial aircraft, that they also stayed within their approved zones for training. That's very restricted in Europe at the time where they could do these type of exercises. So, you know, we also had a role to make sure that they were in those boundaries and didn't go outside that, and that, you know, no one else entered that airspace also.
And when you say you were deployed to the field, you were really in a field, right?
A lot of times we were. When I was in Bremerhaven, we had it was called a tactical control air post, and it was a large mobility unit that you could fold up. Just think of like a pop-up tent type thing, but on a larger scale than that, that the whole squadron would deploy, and it would all collapse and fold in together. And you went out into the field, the actual field, and you set it up. And you brought the radar in, and that had to become operational. And all the operational people and support people, the maintenance people were assigned. And the whole unit you trained, you know, in the event that a contingency happened where you had to deploy. So you are continually practicing, you know, your hurry up and waiting to, you know, make sure that you are operationally ready. So in the event that something does happen, you're prepared and you can go out and set up the unit to be able to provide the close air support for our troops.
What did the German government think about this? Now, they're part of NATO, but did you get a sense from them?
It was pretty favorable. I think that the Germans did have a military. I think they have a requirement within their country that, you know, all young people have to serve like a year or something. They're not a formal type military. At least a lot of them were formal. They were more like a reserve type unit that came in. But they were very favorable of the military. I think... you know, they did not like if you were deployed, you had to be very careful about the farmland that you use, that things were returned in the same state as when you got it, that trees or shrubs or crops or whatever weren't destroyed. And so that was a big oversight that we had, and that the German government made sure that the space and the area was not destroyed. Mm-hmm. And that we were restricted, like you could only deploy like on certain days of the week. Like on Sundays you weren't allowed to convoy, which means, you know, you would have all the troops leaving at one time in a big backup of, you know, different trucks and supplies and trailers and things that all would move down the road together. You were a little bit restricted on that, but those rules were clearly identified, and the unit knew, you know, when they could deploy or how they could deploy and how long they could be out. And so there were limitations that the German government did have with the Air Force that were agreed, you know, upon within the country and at, you know, a different level than, you know, what I was at. But there were rules and guidelines that they had to comply with. And mostly I think they were pretty good, you know. I think it all seemed to work out well.
So after that, back to the USA?
No, after Bremerhaven, I went down to Wiesbaden, which was in the central part of Germany. And I was in a unit there that was a smaller mobility unit. And at this point... we also provide close air support, but we would deploy with mainly now your radar unit. Everything was contained in like the size of a small trailer. And then it was a smaller unit that we probably had about 60 people assigned in our unit. Mm-hmm. And so you could really then get, you know, like at that point, then you're deploying in pup tents. And, you know, I remember you would set up these tents and it would be wet and rainy and cold. And I thought, what am I doing in this middle of this cornfield here with rows of furrows of dirt that had been dug up and water streaming through my tent, you know? So, but it was a challenge and, you know, it was interesting.
What's the longest time period that you would be out in those circumstances?
Maybe four days, okay. 3 to 4 days at a time. So you could, you know, it was livable, but it was at the time you're just, you know, it's not comfortable. And it made me appreciate being in the Air Force and not with my fellow Army troops that, you know, that was what they continually did all the time. So I had appreciation for being in the Air Force then.
So you could always come back in and stop in one of those nice German pubs.
Yes.
Tell us about...
Gasthaus, yeah.
Now, I've never been to Germany, for which I'd like to rectify, but I hear all these stories. Tell me about the typical visit to a Gasthaus.
Well, it would be, you know, you would usually, we'd go with groups of people. It would always be kind of a party festival type atmosphere. You'd have a great meal of schnitzel or Spätzle or, you know, some really nice hearty German food and a couple of beers that you would drink down with it. And, you know, it was always interesting to see the different types of vessels that they would use to put the beer. You get a big stein, or you get something that looked like a giant test tube that sat on the floor that, you know, either a yard size or a yard and a half. And, you know, you had to really navigate that around your table and get it balanced so the beer doesn't slosh in your face. But that was always, you know, part of the evening too. And so it was fun. You'd stay out late at night and eat delicious food, pomfrits and currywurst and schnitzels and bratwurst and, you know, all types of good things with French fries and potatoes and vegetables. That was good.
We've got a lot to cover in a short time. So now let's bring you back to the States. You're at Hill Air Force Base.
Yes, I came back to the United States. I got out of weapons controlling. At the time, we were just sending in AWACS, which was an aircraft that surveilled over Saudi Arabia. We were helping out Saudi Arabia. And at the time, they would not allow the women controllers to go into AWACS because at the time, the Saudi pilots did not want to listen to women weapons controllers. It was just kind of something in their culture that they did not approve of. And so it allowed that was hard for women to progress if you didn't go into that type of career field, to that type of training. So they were allowing the women, if they wanted to, they could get out of that career field. So I elected to make a change in my career, and at the time I needed to come back to the United States, and I got into administration at that time, and I came back to Hill Air Force Base, which is outside Ogden, Utah. Beautiful Wasatch Front there between Salt Lake City and Ogden, and I was assigned there. That's where I grew up, and I had to return home.
And on a personal note, that's where we met.
That's true. That's right. That's right. We met there.
I was assigned there, and we started dating seriously toward the end of my assignment. So you were able to come with me to California.
Correct. Correct. We were married there at the end of our assignment.
Married in Utah.
The end of your assignment, yep, in Utah. And you went on to California, Norton Air Force Base. And then after you're married, then you can apply for an assignment with your fiancé until you are married. And then once you are married, then you can go in and apply through the personnel office for something that they call a joint spouse assignment. And that took about 45 days. So we were separated about 45 days after we first got married. And then I followed on and joined you in Southern California.
Now, in Utah, you were working for a wonderful gentleman, Major General Marquez.
Leo Marquez, yes.
And I have a feeling in the background helped you get that assignment.
Well, I think a little, you know, I mean, yeah. he was a great person to work for, and I was his protocol officer there at the Ogden Air Logistics Center for 2 years, and he made some calls and just said, you know, this person would make a good, you know, executive officer for you. So after leaving Hill Air Force Base, where I had had a good, you know, good assignment there, I was able to go on and be the wing executive officer at the 63rd Military Airlift Command, and they provided transport C-141 cargo airplanes, big support there for military airlift that came out of Southern California that supported the Pacific and
the whole Western Pacific. We lived in a little town called Redlands. You want to talk a little about Redlands, what it was like to live there?
It was a suburb of, I guess you would call it now, a suburb of Los Angeles. I mean, that whole area just was so crowded. Moving to, after used to being to living in smaller communities, that was living in the big city out that area. It was very crowded. The interstates were crowded. But Southern California was very nice, very enjoyable. That area used to be a orange growing area, a lot of orange orchards, and every spring you'd smell these just beautiful, beautiful orange blossoms that were out and flowering, and then the oranges were just, you know, everywhere, and it was just a beautiful area, and they were slowly eroding, you know, people were, they were getting torn down and homes building and growth and all that, but Southern California was a nice assignment. I enjoyed it, and that was a great location. I worked as the wing executive officer there, a lot of long hours there for the wing commander and the vice commander, with a lot of administrative duties, making sure that itineraries and trips and performance reports and, you know, the coordination between the commander and his staff, you know, went smoothly.
Mm-hmm. And so from there, I got the assignment first out of there, and then you got an assignment to the Pentagon, again back with General Marquez.
Correct. Now, that's where he helped me get that assignment. When we left California, you had gotten your assignment, and so I had called a boss and said, hey, I'm coming to D.C. Is there, you know, any jobs or any recommendations that you might want to advise me about, you know, what I could do or where I should look to work? And he offered, I want you to come work for me. So a former boss hired me again. So off we went to Washington together, and I worked as the first female executive officer for the Deputy Chief Staff of Logistics, which was in the Pentagon, and for the Air Force. And that was a great assignment, a demanding assignment, long hours there. We did not have children, which was good because, you know, a 12 to a 13-hour day was not unusual. And just a lot of long hours and a very challenging job, a good job, learned a lot there, and worked for just wonderful people in my career that I had a chance to work with or come across. And that was a nice assignment. You were involved with, you know, the Air Force headquarters is there, but so are all the other services. The Department of Defense, that's where their headquarters is. So I was able to then, you know, work and see daily people that were in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, all right there in one building. The Pentagon is just a large building, large, expansive building, and just a great opportunity as a young officer to have that opportunity and be able to work there and coordinate and work with, you know, just a lot of professional people that work hard every single day to, you know, defend our country and get the budget right and get, you know, the programs running smoothly and funded. And it was just a great opportunity.
In our last couple of minutes, tell me how you decided to get out of the Air Force. How'd that go?
We decided as a family that I would separate from the Air Force at the time. They were offering a program for people to get out of the service. And I decided to just start a career as a mother then and raise my two sons, Kevin and Matthew, and enjoyed that opportunity being with them and just enjoyed sharing my career with them as they were growing up. So that was the end of my career as an officer, but I then took on a more important and challenging one of being a mother. So that was my service to our country and to my family.
Well, I want to thank Caroline. Thank you, dear, very much for being a guest today.
It was an honor and a privilege to be able to share my experience and to just recount the wonderful experience I had serving with many outstanding young men and women who serve our nation every day to defend our liberties and freedoms that we try to live up to. Thank you.
I may be a little bit biased, but I think she excelled in both careers. Hope you've enjoyed today's edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy. For more information, call 919-917-7729. That's 919-917-7729.